I want to proceed quickly to our next sister, who has the great honor of introducing our very special guest of honor for tonight. So Sister Yolanda McLean, our Diversity Vice President on the National Executive Board.
Good evening, sisters and brothers. Gloria Mills is Director and National Organizer on the Equality Issues for UNISON, which is the largest union in the United Kingdom. She was elected president of the Trade Union Congress, TUC, in September of 2005 and served as president and vice president in 2005 to 2007. She created history when she became the first black woman to be elected as a TUC president. As president, Gloria chaired the TUC General Council, Executive and Committees, and Congress. Gloria is currently a member of UNISON's Senior Management Group and has worked as a senior national office official and manager in the trade union movement for over 20 years. Gloria has held several senior positions in the public service unions, UNISON and NUPI, as Director of Equality Opportunities, National Organizer and National Secretary Managing Union's Equal Opportunities Department, Strategic Programs, Projects, and Campaigns on Equality, Employment, and Policies Issues. Prior to this, she worked as a regional organizer and in law publishing, where she was mother of the chapel in the print unions, NATSOPA and SOGET, and held several senior elected positions. Gloria is a member of the TUC General Council, Executive Committee, and Chair of the Race Relations Committee, and ETUC Women's Committee. She's Vice Chair of Public Services International's World Committee. Gloria has a master's degree in business administration and in a professional capacity is a member of the Chartered Institute of Personal and Development and Chartered Management Institute. She is a member of the Editorial Advisory Board of Equal Opportunities Review, Employment Appeal Tribunal, and has written a range of articles and publications on equality, employment, and institutional racism. In 2005, Gloria was awarded the CBE for Service to Equal Opportunities in the Queen's New Year's Honors. In 1999, received the MBE for services to the trade union movement. In 2006, Gloria received an honorary doctorate in law from Staffordshire University. Sisters and brothers, this is a great honor and a privilege this evening. Please join in welcoming Sister Gloria Mills.
Thank you very much, Yolanda, for that introduction. I'd like to thank Paul, your national president. I'd like to also thank Maureen, Lucy, and everyone else, and also to thank you for making this conference possible. I want to say, hearing, the introduction of me, it always sort of, make me think, oh, really? Is that really me? Because I want to say I started off in the workplace in law publishing. I went to work in law publishing in 1978, and I always say 20 years. Someone said, say you've been in the trade union movement for 20 years rather than 30 years. It makes you sound a bit younger, but I'd own up. This is my 30th year in the trade union movement. Now, I started as, a trade union member. I went to my first trade union meeting about 2 months after I'd started. And I asked a question. And the question I asked concerned me greatly because I did not like the way that women were being treated. I could not understand why it was easier if you were a man to phone in with a problem with your car, if you had a punctured tire. You know, the culture in the organization was one where you had no problems. But if you had a child and childcare problems, you had to phone in and say you were sick. And I couldn't understand why it was easier for a man to phone in and had a problem with his car, never lost any money, never had any problems, did not have to explain himself, but women had to explain themselves. And it dawned on me how unequal the workplace was and why it was important for something to be done about it. So I'm delighted to be here today. I think it's a great honor, it's a great privilege for me to share with you at this National Bargaining Conference on Women's Equality some of the experiences of bargaining for equality in general in the trade union movement in the UK, and in particular on women's bargaining. I want to talk about the position of women in British trade unions, also about the progress we've made in my own union, our approach to equality bargaining, and most of all, I want to talk about the issue that I found that was so important in the workplace, that was recognizing the difference between women being a majority group and having influence, and actually being the majority group that leveraged that influence into power to change the structure, the culture, and also the agenda of the union. So I want to say, first of all, that I do support what Paula said, and quite clearly I think women workers should not give an inch as far as, you know, the recession and the economic downturn is concerned. When the economy was booming, women workers were shortchanged, and in the UK, in terms of equal pay, women were shortchanged to the tune of £25 billion. And, you know, while the bankers in the City of London and around the world paid themselves huge bonuses and pay rises, so women did not cause the recession, they did not cause the crisis of capitalism, and they should not have to pay the price for the world economic crisis. Now, when the women, the European trade union women leaders met in Turin in Italy on the 31st of October 2008, I actually made it quite clear that the 89 trade union represented there, representing 43 European countries and 30 million trade union women, that we sent a message to the world leaders, that we had to challenge the assumption that the consequences of the global crisis is gender neutral, because we know that history shows that the most vulnerable groups are women, migrants, children and elders, the disabled, who actually are the first victims when it comes to any financial downturn. And we actually said that we warned the European leaders that, you know, that the risk of not focusing on gender and the gender impact of the ongoing crisis will actually lead women into deeper poverty. And we wanted to ensure that, you know, that the whole question of poverty, about particularly about women and families falling deeper into poverty, was something that had to be looked at. And we wanted to see effective mechanisms in place to ensure that women did not have to bear the brunt of the world economic crisis. So we called for a whole range of areas where we wanted to see action taken in terms of, you know, ensuring that, you know, women continue to have good working conditions, that we continue to fight for a living wage, not a minimum wage, a living wage, because we find in a number of places the trade union movement, particularly in the UK, have secured a living wage, a minimum wage. But what happens is what employers have been trying to do is to make the minimum wage the actual workplace rate. And we want to ensure that we continue having that trade union premium. That is, that, you know, if you are a member of a trade union, you get more than the minimum wage. You get a decent living wage. And being a member of a trade union is the difference between poverty pay and the difference between low pay and the difference between a living wage. And we wanted to get that message quite clear to people, because it is through trade unions and having a trade union premium that you do improve your standard of living, that you do improve the position of your family in society, and that you do improve your own position in society. So we wanted to make sure that the trade unions were at the forefront in terms of organising women workers, and that, you know, women were at the forefront of everything that we do. Now, in terms of my union, I just want to say that Unison is the largest public sector union in the UK. We represent 1.354 million workers, 40% of whom work part-time, and 70% of all members, in fact, 74% of all members, over 1 million, are women members. When we formed Unison in 1993, just over 15 years ago, from the merger of three unions, New Pinago and COSY, women and equity sequin groups insisted that they should have a voice in the decision-making structures of the union to ensure that women's interests and equality were kept at the heart of the union. And women were determined to break away from the stereotypical image which happened in my previous union, NUP, where women were the majority group, 70% of the membership, but had to rely on five reserved seats in the decision-making structures. And, you know, that was something that we found totally unacceptable, because what happened is that women ended up, being in a marginal position, unable to get issues like equal pay on the agenda. So we wanted a new structure, we wanted a new system, we wanted to change the image of the trade union movement so that the trade union movement were more representative of workers. And what we found important was that we had to find a mechanism to leverage power for women, because what we had was a situation where men actually exercised disproportionate levels of power in the decision-making structures. So what we wanted was to move away from the old way, the old model of doing things, whereby, you know, unions bolted on equality after the women complained about it. And the only time you ended up having, you know, and women and black members and disabled members and LGBT members is when you complained about the fact that you were excluded from the decision-making process or from a publication. So we wanted to move from that old bolted-on approach to a new mechanism which ensured that we had a built-in approach. That built-in approach, we wanted it to be part of the foundations of the union. We wanted a new vision to achieve transformational change. We wanted to change the agenda, we wanted to change the structure, and we wanted to change the culture of the union. Women also wanted a shift in the balance of power, because traditionally, as I said, men were in a minority in membership, but held all of the positions of power in the union. And women wanted to achieve a more equitable balance in the distribution of power, to share power in partnership with men. I had to make the case, as a feminist, that, you know, I did not hate men. My partner is in the room. But I wanted to say that, you know, we wanted an equitable basis to distribute and share power. We wanted a felt fair principle. So, you know, we can actually have fairness and we can have feminism as well. And so we decided we wanted a built-in approach, and that's exactly what we did. We built equality into the rule book, we built it into the structures, we built it into the decision making. Now, if you have 74% of the power in a union, as women had, it was an important opportunity to use that as political leverage. Because if you actually took 74% of all the seats, you no longer had to complain about, you know, equal pay not being on the agenda, childcare not being on the agenda, work-life balance not being on the agenda. You no longer had to influence the men to put it on the agenda. You could actually take the position and put it on the agenda yourself. It was a big issue because we had a lot of debate amongst women, women who did not feel it was fair, you know, because they had been conditioned into believing that, you know, that they should play a secondary role. Well, I tell you, I was brought up never to play a secondary role to my brother. Now, my mum made a rota, and my brother had to do his share of the dishwashing in the same way that I had to do my share of the dishwashing. So as far as she was concerned, you know, that, you know, we had to be treated equally. Now, I have actually taken that into the trade union movement because I think we really have to challenge the stereotypical images, the stereotypical typecasting, the gender stereotyping and conditioning that we've seen as girls and as we see happening in society. So it was very important because one of the things that, you know, I've always been conscious of is that, I don't know if you noticed the behaviour with children, that girls are always being told you had to be good, and then boys could afford to be naughty, and you couldn't understand why girls could not get away with being naughty, but boys could. And I remember seeing, you know, a poster that said, you know, that good girls go to heaven and bad girls go everywhere, and I decided I wanted to go to heaven, but I wanted to go everywhere as well. So I decided I would go to heaven, but I still wanted to go everywhere as well. So it was actually challenging the status quo, challenging the norm, and because the status quo has never served women's interest. It's always failed women, and that's from my experience. And the only way you can make change is to force the pace of change by challenging the way things are done. If it's done in a certain way all the time and it's not delivering the goods, then you need to try new ways to ensure that it does deliver the goods. And so it was trying to have an accommodation that would bring about change. Now, it's not very easy, and sometimes people are not very clear about how it should be done. But the biggest battle we faced was to convince women that they could exercise power and that they can do it in a way that was sharing the agenda with men and making progress that included men but not excluded women. And that was the key message we had to get across. So we had this built-in approach. We included equality in the rules and the aims and the values of the union. We included the right to be represented in all areas of decision-making. But we were not going to be offended by having reserved seats. We wanted a mechanism that would guarantee women the level of influence that their membership commanded. So if on the national committee, 74% of our membership are women, then on the national committee, the executive committee, 74% should be women. And that's exactly what we achieved. Every committee... Now, I know at the time, Cosmopolitan said that the feminist revolution has started in unison and they weren't sure where it was going to end. Well, you know, the reality is it's not a revolution. It's just about fairness, as far as I'm concerned. So we had this decision-making structures. We had the right to our own committees. That is for all of the equality groups, women, LGBT, lesbian, gay, trans, bisexual and transgender committees. Disabled members had their own committees, and black members had their own committees as well. And one of the things I learned from the print unions, you know, you had to get it in the rule book. Because if you did not get it in the rule book, then you won't make progress. I did not want to spend my time arguing with all the, every part of the powers that be that, you know, we needed to have a right to a committee, to a conference, or the right to participation. Because if you get it in the rule book, you need a two-thirds majority to get it out of the rule book. Now, I want, in a union with 1 million women, I wanted to see which man would stand up and ask to get rid of some of these equality committees or conferences. But I must say, you know, you never know what happens. You have to be eternally vigilant, and that's what we intended to be at the outset. So we had to move from the margins into the mainstream of the structures. Now, the mechanism we used were what people call the Holy Trinity of Unison. Proportionality, women represented in proportion to their membership at any level of the union. So if you had 80% of women in a particular sector or service group or occupational group or branch, then 80% of the branch will be members, the branch committee. That's only fair. Fair representation to ensure that low-paid, equity-seeking groups and people were represented on the basis of social class. So, for example, on our national executive, in addition to having 74% women members, we also had 13 seats guaranteed for part-time women who were low paid, so that they too can have a voice in the decision making. And we also had all of our equality-seeking groups, the four groups, all represented as part of fair representation as well. So black members, lesbian and gay members, LGBT members, disabled members, every one of them were part of the structures. And then we had self-organization, which gave us the space, the capacity, and the ability to be able to meet, to build our confidence, to ensure that, you know, we actually in the union had this group of women and equity-seeking groups coming forward to participate in the mainstream of the union. So those were the mechanisms that actually helped us to achieve that vision of what I told you about earlier on, about transforming the union's agenda, the culture and the structure, but also shifting the balance of power. And so what happened is it was important to have that political leverage because that political leverage decided the composition of the committees. It made it representative of women. It also made sure that women's interests were at the top of the collective bargaining agenda and the negotiating agenda. It also meant that women had voting leverage because voting leverage is so important. One of the things I always understood as a minority is that you can have a voice in democracy, but unless you use your vote and you have the power of the vote, you cannot change the decisions if there's no political will to change the decision. And it was really important that women had to recognize that, 1 million strong gave you a lot of political but voting leverage as well. So it was deciding who got elected. And if someone was not on a progressive slate and they did not support your agenda, you just said goodbye to them. And so what happened is a lot of women realized how important the politics of union and the machine of union politics was and how important they were, because they kept phoning me and saying, Gloria, we've got people, so many people are phoning us to tell us that they're standing and should we vote for them? And it was saying, well, you now have the voting leverage and you will have to decide whether or not that person will be responsible but also accountable for promoting the issues that women wanted on the bargaining agenda. Now, that happened 15 years ago, and I can tell you, overnight, the whole bargaining agenda was transformed. Every issue that women wanted on that agenda was on the agenda, and the merger was in 1993. By 1997, equal pay, the first agreement that my union signed in local government for over 1.5 million members was a job evaluation equal pay agreement to bring about, pay equity in the public services. That was very important. In less than 4 years, equal pay negotiation was no longer a dream, it was a reality. And about 5 years later, in the National Health Service, the union negotiated the first comprehensive equal pay agreement in health, Agenda for Change, again, removing pay inequity in the National Health Service. So those are two examples of how, we have been able to change the agenda, to change the structure, but we are on the verge of, trying to change the culture. Cultures are always very different and more difficult to change. But it was about ensuring that, that the people who exercise power on behalf of women were not just responsible to the constituency of women that they represented, i.e., the majority of the membership at the time, 1 million women, but that they were also accountable. So the voting leverage ensured that accountability. So in essence, women ended up taking ownership of the collective bargaining agenda, not just to change their position in the workplace, but they have used that to change their position and the position of women in society, and they're using that political and voting leverage to change the position of women in the world by actually promoting an agenda of global and international solidarity, speaking up and speaking out for women who are less able and fortunate to speak for themselves. So So what we had to do was, in addition to challenging the gender stereotyping, we had to build women's confidence, not just challenging the status quo, but actually finding new models in order to make progress. But we had to ensure that women were also vigilant to achieve progress, that they had to keep not just challenging the status quo, but they also had to begin to put in place the strategies and the mechanisms to achieve those changes. So we started particularly around equal pay. We had a strategy of educate, negotiate, and litigate. There were three clear parts to that strategy. Now, we educated women and men. The men, you know, there were lots of men. In fact, quite a lot of the male negotiators have been excellent in terms of winning a lot of equal pay for work of equal value at local level. And it was through that education of, you know, of how the bargaining process worked, because bargaining has always been seen as a mystique, you know, very difficult area for negotiators. And I became a negotiator before I started dealing with equality. I only started dealing with equality in the late, I think it was 1988, because the trade union movement was under so much pressure under Margaret Thatcher's rule. We weren't winning anything. We had nine pieces of trade union legislation. We were in we had a lot of anti-trade union laws. And the only way we could actually sustain our membership growth and also sustain our relevance to members in the workplace was through the equality agenda. And that's when we shifted the agenda away from pay to equal pay, to childcare, to maternity rights, to work-life balance, and it's in those areas we have had the biggest growth in trade union membership and the biggest advances. So it's about making the union relevant to members, but it's about gaining and winning at the workplace. So with our strategy on equal pay, we have negotiated huge agreements. We have litigated over 40,000 cases. We have, in the last year alone, we have trained over 5,000 activists on equality issues, and 600 of our officials have been trained on equal pay. And that demonstrates that it's an important and it's a serious issue. And the reason why we felt that we had to, and I should also say, as a result of that, 3 out of 4 of our chief negotiators are women. Now, so we've gone from a situation where men have always predominated the negotiating and collective bargaining arena. They were always the chief negotiators, particularly in my time when I joined the trade union movement, to a position now where it's no longer a novelty to have a woman leading the bargaining. And I think that's a huge sign of the progress that we have made, and a huge part of the reason why it is we've had so many recent successes. But what we've also tried to do is to look at where trade union women leaders are coming from. Now, in the European, the TUC and is part of the European TUC. So we also bargain and negotiate within the European context. Now, if you look in the European context in terms of trade union leadership, we know that in a number of unions, women representation in leadership position is really poor, terribly poor. If you, out of 65 confederations, we have women leaders in just four of the 65. And when I talk about leaders, I mean women who are presidents. 27 out of the 75 vice presidents are women, and 4 out of 44 general secretaries are women. So women are not doing as well in positions of leadership as they should. Now, one of the things that we found out, that is that there was a disconnect between women's structures and the collective bargaining structures. So I'm really pleased that you've done this task force meeting. I read your papers, all of the papers on Let's Get Cooking, and it's an absolutely brilliant report in terms of looking at how the link between women's structures and collective bargaining structures are so important, because it's the lack of the link between the women's structures and the collective bargaining structures that leads to women's issues not being on the collective bargaining table. So I think that's important that you look at that. Point of the work that we were doing in terms of education was to empower women. We wanted to ensure that women were economically empowered but politically empowered as well. So it was a twin strategy of political empowerment, economic empowerment, and we had to look at education and what strategy we had to empower women. And we had to distinguish, we had to teach a lot about the difference between influence and power, because influence is so limited in its scope. It's about persuading others to implement change, whereas with power is having that direct ability to make the change that's necessary. And I would say, I think, who was it? President Obama, I think, said he recognized that. Was very important to distinguish how you actually go from influence to power. Now, I believe that together women are an irresistible force for change. I think we can create the change we want to see, and I think that we can be the change we want to see as well. I think we can start by laying the foundations today and building the legacy that others will inherit tomorrow. And I think it's really important to talk about the legacy, because it's what we do today that would determine what our children and future generations inherit. And it's really important that we look at the way that power operates. In the UK, we've done a survey looking at, you know, how we get political power, not just in trade unions and the workplace, but also in terms of, you know, society. And we have what is called a Sex and Power Index. And what it does, it looks at the position of women in power and influence. And it also looks at, you know, how long, how many years it would take to achieve equality. And what it found that, you know, progress in society in terms of women's progress is at a snail's pace. Now, this report said that a snail takes 2 minutes to cover 13 inches. That's the one that has the record, and that's the fastest snail. It takes 2 minutes to cover 13 inches. And it says that so a snail could crawl the entire length of the Great Wall of China in 212 years, just 12 years longer than the 200 years it will take for women to achieve equal representation in Parliament in the UK. So all the progress we're making, the reality is that progress is still at a snail's pace. So, you know, to wait 40 general elections, you know, when I don't think I would be here, but I'm not sure who would be here to achieve that in, you know, we just cannot wait. We have got to become impatient for equality. And, you know, and I really think that, you know, we need to make sure that the change happens in our lifetime. You know, I never dreamt when I started in the print unions in 1978 that I would ever become president of the TUC. It's just that I just kept fighting and chipping away. And, you know, not giving an inch. And I think that, you know, sometimes you don't have to be as accommodating as others want you to be. And it's... Now, you know, a lot of people think I haven't got a sense of humour. I could tell you I do not have a charisma bypass. I keep telling my colleagues that in the British Trade Union all the time. But the reality is that, you know, you have to be very firm at times and say, no, I will not move over. Because, you know, it's expected that women will move over. It's expected at times that, you know, that women will not argue the rate for the job. Well, I've always believed in the rate for the job, and I will always argue for women to take nothing less but the rate for the job and never feel. And never feel any way about it. Why should you feel any way about it? You know, one of the things I learned is that men argue. And I think, well done to them. They argue the rate for the job because they know that, you know, it's the best pay that determines the level of the pension you get when you retire. And if you're on low pay, you know, you work for poverty pay. You know, you end up living on poverty pay. And most times, a lot of women end up living without a pension. Only 12% of women in the UK have a full state pension. 12%. And my parents' generation, they had what was called a married person. You know, married women's, they paid the married woman stamp. If you paid the married woman stamp, if you were married, you had to, you know, you just paid a few pence when you worked. And when they retired, they were given 18 pence. I don't know how much it means. I think it might be about 9 cents rather, in Canadian money. 18 pence. And they had, at 60, to wait 5 years until their husbands retired in order to get half of his pension. Now, that's an injustice. And, you know, and it's something that should not happen. But that's the reality. And I say women have to, and we have to make sure that that young women understand that they have got to fight their corner for a decent living wage. They've got to fight their corner for decent pension, decent childcare, and we should not feel guilty for standing up and demanding what's right. Now, so the union collective bargaining agenda have to shape our equality priorities, not just in the home, but in the workplace and in society. It's about ensuring fairness at work, but it's also about ensuring fairness and a fair deal for women, for men as well. Because the one thing I said to a lot of the men who did not support me in 1982, when I wanted to take up equal pay in the print unions, was the fact that as long as women's wage, you know, is lower than men's wages, that men's wages will not rise higher. You know, what employers do, they actually keep women's wage down, and by keeping women's wage down, they in effect keep men's wage down as well. And what you have people in employment who are working, you know, for poverty wages, because what you have more in-work poverty and more people reliant on benefits, particularly in the UK, reliant on working family tax benefit, reliant on childcare tax benefit, and reliant on a lot of welfare reform benefits to make up, you know, a decent living wage. And that should not happen. So I think it's important that we do have a partnership between men and women, a partnership of strategic alliances where we work together, because, you know, and we also need to ensure that, you know, that in this current economic crisis, it's set to get worse before it gets better. You know, I think I read yesterday that the IMF believes that the USA, Europe and Japan are now entering a period of depression. Unemployment is rising faster than at any time. In the UK, women's unemployment is rising twice the rate of men's unemployment. Now, we have a precarious labour market, and it will have a negative impact on salaries and on pay levels. And Paul was so right what he said about, you know, the approach to negotiation, because many companies are now using the recession and the bleak economic situation to seek salary and pay freezes. They're striking fear into workers to choose between job security and no pay, to choose between low pay and no pay, to choose between a pay cut and a job cut. And, you know, and also the fact that the gender pay gap, you know, remains, and in some places, some companies are demanding a 25% pay cut. So as trade unions, you know, we need to ensure that our members at all levels, particularly members who are bargaining, continue to keep informed of what's happening in terms of their employer's financial situation. And one of the, you know, my previous general secretary actually told me, that was Rodney Bickerstaff, I worked with him for about 20 years, he said to me, pension will be one of the biggest issues for women in your generation. And he said it was an important issue for women to look at and to understand how it was going to impact on them. And because of that, I actually went and did a master's degree in financial strategy to look at what was happening in terms of, you know, companies' accounts. Because it was about looking at what the ratios are, you know, how the companies were performing, what was on balance sheet and off balance sheet. Most of the time, we don't know what's happening to our pensions. It's off balance sheet, we're told. The company goes bust. We don't even know what's happening with it. We have to take an interest in company accounts. We have to read, you know, the footnotes in companies' account. We have to be able to be vigilant, to be looking around all these company registration houses and, you know, all these financial services authorities to make sure that we keep an eye on our pension. Because if we don't, you know, as trade unionists, we will end up retiring and not knowing whether or not we will have a pension. It's really important that we do look at this issue. It's one of the most important issues that we have to look at, and it's important that we have the tools, you know, to look at what is happening. And we need more workers to become pension trustees, more workers on the board of those companies managing pension schemes, looking at what's happening, preventing companies from using our money for their own ends. So it's very important that, you know, we look at this issue. And the other thing as well is, if we don't, you know, we have families at the moment having to choose between eating and heating. That's the reality, you know, because we have a backdrop of spiraling food prices, spiraling fuel prices, and we really do need to recognize that things will get worse before it gets better. So it's really important that we look at these issues. High quality public services depends on having a good economy, but we should also understand that as the taxpayer, as the government use public sector money, taxpayers' money, to bail out these failing companies and to bail out these greedy banks, you know, then it means that there will be less money going into the public services. There will be less money to fund pay for public services and also to fund health, education, and a lot of public service provision. So we, as you know, we also have to be the custodian of what governments are doing in terms of, you know, the extent of these bailouts. Because our diversity, working together for all of the groups, is one of the biggest strengths that we have. And I think it's really important that we look at delivering our core objectives, not just about, you know, equal pay, but we ensure that during this time of recession that, you know, that pay inequality and equal pay does not fall off the bargaining agenda, that pay justice for women must continue to be on this bargaining agenda. So, I'm not sure. I think I better stop now because I have a tendency to just go on. But just to say that, you know, I think the irony is that we have seen that, you know, we've been told that globalization was going to bring us a lot of benefits. Well, I don't know about you, but I have not seen the benefits of globalization and global integration. What I have seen is that global integration has helped the bankers to ruin the economies of so many countries and companies in the world at the same time. That's what global integration has brought about. We also know that, you know, the fact is that, you know, in the last financial crisis in 1929 and the Great Depression, that it was workers who paid the price with widespread job losses, unemployment rates of over 30%, and a catastrophic slump in salaries, in standard of living, and deep and dark periods of poverty in this world. And, you know, so what we do need is to have strong alliances across the globe. We need to make sure that workers across the globe are united together in actually looking at what's happening in terms of this global crisis. But we need to have more effective coordination on pay bargaining. We need to also ensure that our members are fully trained to bargain based on the evidence of what companies' accounts and companies' position, and not bargain out of fear of pay cuts or job losses. And we need to ensure that the politicians are accountable for every penny, every cent that they actually spend in our name in bailing out, you know, the crisis of capitalism. So we also, it's so important that we recognize that that we've had in the last 10 years, particularly in Europe, we've had a huge growth in women's employment. And women have played a key role in shaping the future of Europe and in particular in the UK. You know, the UK economy has always been lauded for being a successful economy because it's been built on the fact that more women have gone out to work. 50% of the labour market is made up of women at the moment. And, you know, women have played a huge role in actually contributing not just to the prosperity of the UK, but also to the prosperity of Europe. And we've seen the ETUC publishing a new report to coincide with March the 8th, which would show that it's women who are keeping up the trade union membership in the European Union as it is in Britain as well. Trade union membership, particularly women's membership, continue to increase. That's in the last year. So women need trade unions, and trade unions need women. And being in a trade union... being in a trade union, you get a higher premium in terms of your pay, in terms of terms and conditions, and also pension rights. The benefit package of being in a trade union is so much better than not being in a trade union. And I've always said to people, and to a lot of people who do not see the value of unions, that, you know, unions have driven social progress, have driven the social justice agenda. You know, I read in April 2006, The Economist magazine in London had this article. It wrote, forget China, India, and the internet. Economic growth is driven by women. Now, that's what it said. But then it concluded by saying, however, if women are to get out and power the global economy, it's only fair that men should at last do more of the housework. Question mark. So I just want to conclude by saying, you know, the question, if women are powering the global economy, why are they not powering their unions in the workplace and in society? And as I said, women make up 42% of trade union members in Europe, but only a few reach positions of influence and authority. And what we need to ensure is that the unions continue to value women, and women continue to value trade unions, because it's working together in your union that you will be able to achieve all of your goals. I can tell you now that, you know, the union has done so much for me. Because when people say, what is the union doing for you? I say, what are you doing for your union? Ask yourself that. Your union is only as strong as you are in the workplace. And we need to ensure that we go out and get every person who is not a union member in the workplace to become a union member. It's through that tensity, through that unity, through that collective strength, can we negotiate from a position of power. And we have to negotiate from a position of power. And to educate and to raise awareness amongst women that they are powerful in their own right. And if they are powerful, their union is powerful. And if their union is powerful, then their children will have a better future. And it's so important, and their family will have a better future. So the reason why I say this, the power equation is very important, because when things go wrong, women gets the blame. If there are any problems with a child, it's the woman who gets the blame. If there are any problems in society, women gets the blame. We now have a situation where in Europe we say that women are part of what we call a sandwich society. They're working and they're caring for children and they're caring for elderly parents and relatives at the same time. We call them the sandwich generation because our parents, thanks to medical science and everything we should say unto the Lord, that women are actually, people, men and women, are living longer. But we also need to care for them. And so women in their 40s or between 30 and 50 or 30 and 60 at work are having to care for children and also having to care for elderly parents, for dependent relatives and others. So it's important that article in the Economist that said that men should actually take their full responsibility seriously, because the responsibility for work, for caring, for family cannot be a woman's primary responsibility. It has to be a family responsibility. So I want to say, I read when I was 12 years old this quotation, and I'd leave it with you. It says that power without responsibility is tyranny. Responsibility without power is exploitation. And for too long, there has been an imbalance of power in the hands of women, an imbalance of power in the hands of men and responsibility in the hands of women. Well, I think we need to ensure that, you know, women and men are accountable and also responsible. And that's the only way that we can make progress. That is by sharing power and making sure that we force the pace of change and the pursuit of gender equality. Thank you all very much.